I'm Eliza Skinner, and this is On the Podium on the BBC World Service, a place where remarkable athletes reflect on their remarkable lives. Paralympian Scout Bassett and BBC Athletics commentator Ed Harry are alongside me in what is the last episode of this series, which means I get my Wednesdays back to focus on my Olympic goal. I don't have one yet, but what I've learned is that it does start with focus. So, look out. Okay, so what everyday event should be in the Olympics or Paralympics, or both? I'll go first while you're thinking, because honestly, this is a selfish question. I'm like, how can I rig these games so I have a shot at something? And I think if we added an event that was cooking breakfast efficiently, I would go home with a gold. I'm making coffee in one direction. I'm spinning with the other arm, putting the toast in. There's not a movement that is unaccounted for. I feel like it's almost a freestyle, except there is a goal. It's ending up with breakfast.
I like that because there's room for controversy and there's room for rules, because someone can't just turn up and make some toast because that's not in the spirit of it. So there would have to be rules written about cooking, putting milk on things, making juice, maybe making juice from actual oranges.
And showy, like the way that you do it, the spins, the tosses, you know?
There's a video of the British comedians Morecambe and Wise making breakfast to music, and it's fully choreographed. And it's like one of their best sketches. Maybe you could get some tips from that. I mean, you know.
I think folding a bottom sheet on a bed should be an Olympic and Paralympic event. Think about it. It could be very inclusive of all disabilities. Imagine if you're visually impaired, right? You can't see it, but somebody's giving you instructions on where the corners are, where the long pieces are, where the if you had one arm, that could be really interesting, right? I've seen where, like, my friend who has one arm with, like, materials, I don't know if this is gross or not, but, like, she'll put kind of part of it, like, you know, when she's folding clothes, she'll, like, you know, maybe bite the shirt, and as she folds over the arms of the shirt.
That was disappointingly not gross.
Well, I don't know. Do you want a bed sheet that you just washed part of it in your mouth? But either way, I feel like
She's not chewing on it.
Exactly.
That's really good.
I like that.
And you could judge how long it takes you. There could be a time element. There could also be which one is the most compact, right? Like, not really high and fluffy. And then the dimensions, like, which one is the straightest? Because I still can't figure that one out. So I feel like that would be a really good contest.
I love that for two reasons. One is that I feel like there's currently just one ideal that people have, and that's when you get it out of the package. Like, we're supposed to get it back like that.
Yes.
But with this, I feel like people would be like trying to break new ground and be like, well, what if this was the way I fold it? You could get artistic with it.
You could.
Who knows? You could end up with like those cruise ship swans and stuff. They're folding into weird things.
You could do it in individual.
It could be pairs.
Individual, pairs, or in teams. What if there were bunk beds? And in one of the events, you have to make the beds in the both bunks, and how quickly can you do that? Again, there's great scope here for loads and loads of rules and variations, which is sports people love, or administrators love all that. So yeah, I like that a lot. And I'm rubbish at it, so I'd have to train and get better.
Same. I'm so garbage at it.
Right, let's get on the podium. Who's with us this week, Ed?
Our guest today swam at four Olympic Games for Austria, winning two silver medals at the Athens Olympics in 2004. After his swimming career ended, though, there were some major lows. On the other side of it, though, was a new career as a psychotherapist. He was back at the Olympics in 2016 as director of sports psychology for the Brazilian team at their home games. Dr. Marcus Rogan, welcome to On the Podium.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here.
We're going to use some photos to guide our conversation, photos of you and your career. Let's start with that. What's our first photo, Ed?
Well, we are on the podium, Marcus, and this is you on the podium in Athens. And it's distinctive. People who remember the 2004 Games, the spiritual home, the birthplace of the original Olympics, and you've got the laurel on, which was presented to every medal winner there. I'm just wondering, what was going through your head at this point. You're a silver medalist. You won two silvers at that Games. We speak to people on this program who are thrilled with the silver, thrilled with a bronze. What did it mean to you to win your Olympic medals at those Games?
The guy who won, Aaron Pearsall, was disqualified. And so actually right there before, for 24 minutes, I was the Olympic champion. But we both knew, I mean, everyone in swimming knew that he was clearly the better swimmer and he deserved the gold. So we both protested the decision. So in that moment, I was actually relieved. The disqualification had stood, would have always felt like a fraud. So right there, I'm feeling, just great relief that I got the medal that I actually earned.
It might seem strange that somebody could have given you a gold medal, but you just knew it wouldn't have been right and proper. That's what you're saying.
Just didn't feel right. Yeah.
You've been quoted before as saying that the Games felt lonely. That's not usually what we hear. In what way did they feel lonely?
At first, I mean, I think there are three phases of the loneliness, right? Two of them are horrible and one's very beautiful. The horrible ones are the preparation time. You know, when all your friends go out, all your family members get together for all sorts of holidays and you're training and training and training and training. Which is fine, and most people can tolerate because there's this long-range goal in the futures. But it's something I think that breaks a lot of athletes. Then comes the beautiful loneliness during the actual race, which is my favorite part, because you can go to competition and there might be, you know, I don't know, a billion people watching on TV, but you're really just with you, and you can, especially in swimming, right? It's not a contact sport. So you're really in your own world. And it's a very beautiful, relaxing atmosphere. And then I think then there comes the worst part of loneliness, right? That after you win, you have no idea who your friends are, right? You have all these people giving you money. You have all these girls wanting to sleep with you or guys wanting to sleep with you. You have all sorts of friends who like come out of the woodworks, but you have no idea who your real friends are. And that's really, really disorienting.
Wow. Such different mental states. Having them switching between those three must also be really disorienting.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's also addicting, right? That's why you go back to always chasing the race element where it's pure. You are being judged solely on merit. You're doing what you love to do. All the expectations and the regulations are 100% clear.
It's sort of simplified when you're in the race.
Right, right. Life's so simple. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm a comedian. That's my purpose on the show. I'm the clueless comedian, and it sounds very familiar. The experience of being on stage and performing versus being at after parties and meetings with agents and all of that, and all these things that are not what it's about coming at you and getting very confusing and kind of lose your identity.
Oh, absolutely. You lose your identity, and it feels like a new identity is formed for you that you have almost no control over.
These expectations and everything. Yeah.
Yeah. And the companies that run ads with you and, you know, you say yes, right? I mean, I've yet to meet someone. I guess there are some people who turn it down, but very few people turn down like 100,000-pound appearances.
Yeah, I mean, you got to eat.
Right. Yeah.
How hard was it to leave that world of swimming? Because I mentioned in the introduction, you went to four games. And in any sport, to go to four games from Sydney in 2000 up until and including London 2012. And you throw into that European championships and world championships, and not just long course pools, but short course pools as well. Did you leave the sport when you really wanted to leave it, or did you just try and hang on to swimming for as long as you possibly could?
Oh, that's a painful question. Because I did try to quit after 2008. I actually did spend a year in private banking. But the worst part is that as a professional athlete, right, you're at the top of your world, and you get older and older and older, and you don't take those steps between usually 18 and 25 or 18 and 30 when most people build their career. So then when you try to enter a career, you're compared to people who are your age, but your skills are really at the level of an 18 or 19-year-old. And so I found myself in that world in private banking where I was instantly recognized by all customers or clients or investors, but it took them 20 seconds to figure out that I didn't know what I was talking about. You know, and I tried to do the training and try to catch up. And I think I learned a bit, but it was so humbling and embarrassing. It was really, really difficult to deal with. So after that attempted yen banking, I did, swimming you takes a little bit to lose your skills. I still qualified for world championships and had the worst performance of my whole career, followed by like a major international scandal where I was beaten up and sent to the hospital, where I was like, what has my life come to? And then I was like, okay, I'm not ready to let go of that hero identity. And I needed 3 more years to really prepare myself for the real world after professional sports.
Do you think that time in banking was like especially challenging because, in part, because your life had been so focused on exceeding expectations and suddenly you had a completely different set of expectations?
Right. I had a completely different sets of expectations and I was used to being good and winning. My whole identity was built on that. And then it took me too long to accept how far behind I was. That my ego couldn't handle it. I just couldn't handle that identity of being the novice again.
Yeah, once again, who are you? You just lose the identity. Yeah.
I know that for many athletes, that is one of the hardest chapters of their life, is going from being this star athlete or recognizable figure to life after sport. A lot of the times, you know, you're under 40 years old when you're done. You still have a whole life to live. What advice or what suggestions do you have for athletes that are approaching that? Because it's such a struggle for so many of us.
Oh, that's a tough one. So the first advice I'd have is don't pretend it's not going to happen to you.
You're not going to be an athlete forever.
Right. And no matter how much money you have, it's going to happen to you. People think, okay, I have enough money, I can just do what I want. And in many ways you can, but that just really creates bigger risks of making even more stupid decisions. Then the other thing is I would always be around, or make sure I'm around as early as possible, people who genuinely don't give a shit about my athletic performance and who are not paid by me. But that's the key. A lot of people, I find this not just true for athletes, but for all successful people, they surround themselves by more and more people who they pay, which is wonderful. And you can build a lot of lives that way. But there's an authenticity that's lost, because no matter what, whoever you pay has a little bit of an incentive to brown nose you.
That's fantastic advice. And you kind of learned all of that the hard way, because tell us about the end of your career as a professional swimmer, because I know you described this as crashing and crashing hard, but how would you describe that period in your life?
You know, I think it was the Etruscans. There's some ancient civilization that whenever they made a decision, they made the decision sober, then they got drunk. And if they made the same decision drunk, then they knew it was a good decision. So I thought drunk people will always tell me the truth. So I was always in these nightclubs asking people what they really think. And of course, in a nightclub, especially when you just buy everyone drinks, they're like, oh, you're still the greatest. You still got it. I thought, okay, I still got it.
Yeah.
It made sense to me at the time.
Why would you go anywhere else?
Right.
I mean, when you're having that experience, yeah.
Of course, you know, it gets away from you. The beautiful thing about sports, right, is it moves on and moves on. And the younger guys always come and they always get faster and they're unforgiving. And I started losing races I should have never lost. But the real low point was in Rome of 2009, where I performed horribly at the World Championships, where I placed 11th or 12th, and I got way too drunk, and I was kicked out of a nightclub. Because it was one of those beach nightclubs, I just climbed back in. Turned out I wasn't the first one to think about that, because they had a bouncer stationed right there. And if you guys didn't know what boxers who don't quite make the pro level, what do they do for a living, right? They are nightclub bouncers. So they used me as practice for half an hour or so, and ended up in the hospital. And I thought that I had like friends who would help me out. But instead, I had paparazzis outside the hospital window, like making fun of me the whole time. And that's when I was like, okay, this is really not working. And then I went to New York City, and I hid in New York City for a couple of months. But some Austrian tourists would recognize me there. But I was just speak English to them and pretend I wasn't me. But then I was like, okay, I'm gonna slow down. I'm gonna stay in the U.S. I'm gonna start seeing a therapist full time. Start figuring out who I am, what I want to do, and swim a little bit more.
It's interesting the stuff that you're saying about surrounding yourself with people who butter you up. I think that is something that happens to kind of anyone in any career, I would imagine, as you go up any ladder, as you just become a boss.
Yeah.
Once you're someone's manager, someone's boss, they're laughing at your jokes a lot more. They're agreeing with your ideas. They're surviving off of getting favor with you. And I know from my own experience, I got very paranoid about it. Like, do you really mean that? Was that actually it? Oh, yeah. And that can feel very lonely also.
Oh, yeah.
Am I the only one on this side of the glass of my life?
Right. Am I the naked one and everyone's telling me I'm wearing clothes?
Mm-hmm. In 2004, you, at those games, you came in second to the same person in both races. And so often in sport, we focus on the winner or the best. Does it become something that you hold on to, something you replay in your head of coming up just a little bit short? Does it become mental where you think, gosh, maybe I'm never going to be able to beat this person, or maybe I'm never going to be able to win the gold medal or to come in first?
Oh, absolutely. For one, I had at the time a real self-esteem issue where I thought if I'm not the best at what I do, I'm nobody. For it wasn't just at those 2004 Olympic Games, but for 7 years, I was second in the world, which was really frustrating, but it kept me going, right? That's why when I, in 2008, when I won the World Championships for the first and only time, I finally, for about 20 minutes, felt completely complete. That's the crazy thing, that when you have an obsessive dream that you think you need in order to be somebody, when you get it, it actually justifies everything you did for it, but only for about 20 minutes.
It sounds like these medals that you've won have meant a lot of different things to you. How do you feel about the actual awards at this point, about your medals?
Well, I auctioned most of them off for charity. The only medal I have is the United Nations Medal of Honor for Civil Courage that I got for this thing back in Athens, you know, when I protested my own gold. But deep down, I do get a lot of gratification from having been world champion. And the other day, my son had an injury. And I was telling him, well, your blood and your immune system, it gets really strong. And that's why you're going to heal. And then he said, well, but my blood's not the strongest in the world. And I said, well, actually,
it is.
Technically, in one event.
And in that moment, I felt like his eyes, you know, I mean, he doesn't care, right? He doesn't understand, really. He's 5 years old. But in that moment, I was like, oh, you know, that's, I get to be here right now.
Do you ever think what would have happened if I'd been Olympic champion? You were world champion, and then sort of then you were able later on to leave the sport finally on your own terms. But would it have been a positive force in your life to have won a gold medal in Athens, or do you fear it could have veered off in a different direction?
The world championships I won then kept me from winning Olympics that year, because after winning worlds, I thought I was hot. I thought I was like the king of everything. And I was dating a Miss Universe finalist, and we took her to the Olympic Games, and she wrote like a big like society column. And I walked into the Olympic Games, I'm going to win this thing anyway, and forgot to eat breakfast. I was like, oh, I'll be fine. And then ended up fourth, which is literally the worst place to be at the Olympics. But I think in hindsight, I think that was a good thing because it slowed me down. It didn't send me on a higher narcissistic rage. I mean, of course, would I like to be Olympic champion? Of course. But would it have been good for my mental health at the time? No, I don't think so.
Do we have another photo, Ed?
We do. We have photos of family, Marcus. What we're looking at here is a picture of you and your family. I mean, you described so much instability in your life as you were kind of the late noughties and what was happening in swimming and away from swimming. This looks like a perfect, wonderful, stable, lovely family. Your wife, two young boys.
A family of Batman, though.
And you've all got Batman on your t-shirts. I like that. And even one of your son's socks as well. It kind of looks like it's, I love the coordination, but I mean, there must have been times earlier on in your life when you thought, am I ever going to have something as wonderful as this looks? Because this just looks like a really happy mum, dad, and two young boys.
Yeah. I thought for the longest time that it's all about the external stuff, the money, and the fame. And it turns out that's the worst loneliness of all. But the joy I get from the boys and from my wife is something I never expected. I don't know how it happened. I mean, obviously, it's because of my wife, right? But also because I had some really, really good therapists who helped me understand that happiness is an inside job. I always thought that, okay, only have a little bit more money, a little bit more fame, then I'll be happy. And to realize it's actually not that at all, you know, still figuring that out. But my boys are certainly helping with that.
Mm. One of the things I wanted to ask you about is how do you go from, or whether you're an athlete or any career you have, so many people attach their identity, their value in success and fame and money and accomplishments. And it sounds like that was part of your struggle too. How do you go from that to reaching a place where you're able to find your worth in something else?
That's a tough one. So I think there are three steps to it. The first is therapy, where you realize how irrelevant whether you're second, first, or a thousandth in the world really is. That takes some time. The second for me was when I, as a graduate student, got to start seeing patients, which is horrible, right? But if you think of medicine, the people who need it most, like severe drug addicts, people who are really down and out, they don't get the experienced doctors, right? They get graduate students. and they really didn't give a shit about me. You know, so I think my first 100 patients taught me the most because they showed me that Olympic medals couldn't be nothing more irrelevant to someone who's thinking, where can I get my next heroin or now fentanyl high? And then the third, of course, is the family, right? Like children really don't care.
Listening to On the Podium with me, Eliza Skinner, Scout Bassett, and Ed Harry. With us is Olympic silver medalist Dr. Marcus Rogan.
You said when you first tried to retire from swimming and you tried to work in investment banking or the banking sector, and you just felt really out of your depth because everyone else was ahead of you that had more time. In terms of what you do now, you know, psychology, finding that after swimming, having therapy yourself. Was this somewhere, an environment in which you had more to give, or you felt maybe that you didn't necessarily go in there thinking you were years behind, that maybe this was a field in which you belonged?
Yes, it was certainly a field I belonged because my mother is a psychiatrist. My stepfather is a psychologist. So I'd grown up around that and it felt very natural. But then I also had a great couple of years as a narcissist. So I, to this day, can work really well with narcissists. and I know the experience of depression. So I felt less out of depth. Also, the nice thing about psychology, right, it's life experience counts. You know, it's not like accounting where it's a hard, very technical source. Of course, there are technical elements to dialectical behavioral therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy, right? But it's really more about trusting your experience, feeling someone else, paying attention, being able to cry with someone.
So many of the athletes that we speak to, especially the ones that want to talk about mental health, started their athletic journey or had their whole athletic career with no mental health assistance or support. It was just not a part of it, therapy not being a part of it. But you grew up in a home with therapists. Were you aware of that the whole time? Were you thinking, I don't need it because, as you said, you're in this narcissistic phase? Or like, what was your relationship with therapy?
I thought they're all psychologists are idiots.
Oh, wow. That must have made trips home good.
I mean, it really sounds like bull, doesn't it? Right? Sit down and talk about your feelings. You know, what's that going to do? I even looked at classes in undergraduate about psychology. And said, they're too easy. What? This is just nonsense. So I was actively in a beautiful phase of denial.
So it wasn't that there wasn't support there, it was that you knew you didn't need that kind of support. that was
well, I didn't need.
So what changed? You, when you came to America, you said you did get into therapy. What What was that turning point?
Well, no. So there were a couple changes. One is my mother screaming at me. Right? She was like, "Hey, come on." The second, and that's the beautiful thing about psychology. What gets repressed gets expressed. The first therapist I saw was actually a sex therapist. That was like, oh, that's when I started seeing, okay, there is a connection between the mind and the body. And it's not just about complete control and being the boss of everything. That's, I find, usually the entryway for people like me who deny any psychological issues, is there's some physiological symptom that medicine can't explain. And then they, after a lot of frustration, end up in a psychologist who says, hey, maybe look at what your mind's doing.
And then it just sort of branches out from there.
Yeah. Then it becomes fun. Well, because things start working, right? It gets more fun. And then there's more relaxing, more freedom. You're less afraid to be embarrassed all the time. You try less hard to be cool all the time. You feel less awkward. You can cry freely. It's just wonderful.
This is kind of going in a different direction, but so many athletes have in recent years been so outspoken about mental health and performance anxiety, depression. What role do you think social media contributes to that?
So I think there are two factors here. One is that mental health has become kind of fashionable. Too many athletes claim mental health issues and don't see it yet the same way we see physical health, that it's certainly something that can happen, but something that ultimately the athlete is in charge of. Like an athlete who breaks his leg 10 times can't, by on the 11th time, say, oh, I'm such a poor victim, I broke my leg again, right? It's the same thing with mental health, that at some point you do have to start taking responsibility of that. And I'm hoping that the fashionable, oh, I have mental health issues, is going to shift soon to like, okay, I'm taking charge of my mental health and I'm responsible for it. The second component, I think social media is less about the content. I see it much, much colder. I think it's just the time spent when you're looking at a screen versus when you're by yourself and reflecting and thinking. You're missing that, right? Let's say you're on the phone for 45 minutes. That's time you're not spending reflecting. And despite what people think, that's not time you're spending resting for your mind or your body. It's not a break. It's a fake break.
But it feels so much better. It feels better to look at a screen than to just think.
Right.
I want to go back to working with athletes. In your opinion, what do you think is the main reason why an athlete never reaches their full potential, or the biggest hindrance towards further success?
Ooh, that's a good question. If you compare reaching your full potential to depression, right, people think there's one reason, but it's really much, much more like a roof that's leaking. There might be 20 holes in it, right? There's not one hole and, oh, and I fix it and it's good. It's the same with full potential. There's so many different reasons. And we think of it, there's one. No. It's to reach your full potential, you have to cover every single base, optimize your body at the right time. You have to optimize your relationship. You have to have the best coaching, the best nutrition, maybe not the best mental health, but mentally healthy enough or obsessed enough in a balanced way enough to achieve. And then you have to hit it on the right day. So it's a really fragile, really, really tough balancing act that has so many factors that if one of them goes wrong, you're already south of your potential.
What I like, though, is you clearly do it your way and you are you. And I like the way that there's no, just because you're director of sports psychology for the Olympic host, if you want to say something or you feel you need to say something, you're clearly someone who will say that thing.
Well, I think I can still work on that a little bit. I originally studied diplomacy in undergrad. I don't think it's obvious why I wouldn't be a good diplomat.
It does seem that you have shed any kind of fear of shame in this process. You're not worried about other people's opinions and about, you know, saying the wrong thing and being shamed, which I think is sort of the other end of the spectrum from feeling like you have to perform and be perfect and live up to all of these expectations from people.
Well, right. I do live very much free of shame, but there's also such a thing as healthy shame. There's healthy shame, like, prevents you from farting in public.
We're not supposed to do that.
I mean, right. There's things that shame has a healthy function, but I fully agree with you that there's a lot of unhealthy shame that holds a lot of people back.
What role do you think psychology should play in athletic training and preparing people to even be athletes?
Ooh, that's really, really tough, because I think a lot of athletes perform to run away from trauma, and it's a way of healing trauma, right? As, let's say daddy's beating up mommy at home. When he comes home drunk again, I'm going to go to practice because there I don't have to deal with that. Sometimes if you treat the mental health too well, then the athletic performance actually suffers. So it's interesting. I often hear from big coaches, hey, don't fix everything, because otherwise you just create happy, fat people.
Is there no middle ground of extra tools to help process things along the way to prevent complete self-destruction?
Right. So you want to prevent self-destruction, but the idea that mental health leads to athletic success, I don't think it's supported by science.
Oh, that's interesting. So you're basically saying that to have an element of that trauma and that pain is somewhat needed to keep the athlete it can be used as a motivation tool.
Absolutely.
As a comedian, I have no idea what that's like. Comedy is completely, completely different.
I would be curious about that, I have to say.
Oh, comedy? Fraught with trauma. That's why people jump off the roofs of comedy clubs and have tons of addiction problems. Me, I'm fine. But the industry in general, it's tough. A lot of different traumas. I think of it as we're all different little monsters with different shapes. Some people have claws, some people have fangs, some people breathe fire, but we understand that we're all little monsters. We all have something. Anyway, not to make it about me.
No, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Marcus, if you say, you know, that you kind of need the trauma or an element of struggle, and you've described, what may for you have been, self-destructive tendencies at times in your swimming career, can you also see what that trauma was in your own sporting career that helped to push you? What was it that made you, not too happy and not too content to keep striving? Because you were at or near the top of this for, over a decade.
Yeah. I mean, my father walked out when I was a couple of days old. And I looked for him and all sorts of people for the next 25 years. And now our relationship is better than it ever has been. But for the first 20 years, it was at times violent.
Do you come across colleagues from your swimming days? They might know what you do now, or maybe you tell them what you do now. Are they surprised that this is your pathway now? Or do they say to you, I kind of thought you might, or the way you used to speak, or are they claiming that they could see this on the horizon for you even all those years ago?
There are the two sides, right? The one, people say the doctor title is just another medal, which is certainly true, right? I think the greatest way to fake overcoming an insecurity about not being smart enough is to achieve something academically. But the other side is, yes, I did often ask very uncomfortable, very awkward questions at dinner tables in front of parents with friends. So they were like, yeah, okay, that's clearly, finally, now you have a license to do that.
And what about now? You have your practice. I mean, do you actively enjoy working with sports people, or would you rather have in your roster of clients or patients just regular people who have problems that might not lead to winning medals or not winning them, but are just as important and just need to be solved just as much? Or would you like, and do you still work in that sporting sector as well?
I have a really, really good mix now. That part is absolutely fascinating. Every day I get to be in these most intimate, vulnerable moments with very different people. There's nothing more fascinating than the human condition. I really do think I have the best job in the world, is I get to hear what people are struggling with, and also how so many people have such interesting lives that you never hear about. What they're feeling, what they're thinking, what they're afraid of, what they're happy about, what turns them on. It's absolutely amazing. And then there's the other part. I don't know if I should say this openly, but every session I have also helps me build a better relationships in my life. It's unbelievable.
That sounds like a great thing to say.
well, but I do want to admit, I don't want to, like, it's, I think the really good psychologist wouldn't need his patients for anything. And it's somewhat embarrassing to admit that I do get measurable benefit.
Well, that sort of leads to my last question, which is how much would it ruin your life if there were medals for being psychologists? Oh. Mm-hmm. You could compete. Yeah. Oh. I'm kidding.
No. I mean, it's a funny question, but it's also a dark question. Like, why do I need a fancy office in Beverly Hills? Why can't I just meet people in a coffee shop? There is a dark part of me that's still competing and trying to be very good psychologist, when the whole point of psychology is learn to be good enough.
Thank you so much for giving us so much of your time. This was fascinating talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you for giving me the space. It feels wonderful to be listened to and to explore and to laugh.
We'll send you a bill.
That was so good.
Well, he was fascinating.
In a completely different way. I mean, he's put two series of this now. I've never met a guest who's kind of wired that way. The things people do, you don't just have to be good at one thing. You don't just have to be a swimmer and think I'm a swimmer, because look at what he is. Really, truly fascinating.
Sort of what he was saying at the end there, that everybody has a story, that they're fascinating stories, and people that you might never know if you didn't get to sit down and talk to them. Also, I feel like you talked so much about different ways of identity changing and not being prepared to have your identity change. And as he said, it's going to change, definitely for athletes, but for everybody, you know, as you go from defining yourself as a student to defining yourself as whatever, an employee, your job, our whole lives, it's changing, but it can still blindside you.
I'm more towards the sunset of my career than the sunrise, and I can definitely relate in some ways and understand that struggle that so many athletes face when the career is over, because you know, you go from like always being on a stage of some sort, right, always having an audience, to for a lot of athletes, they're not as relevant anymore after their athletic career. And you know, you go from like wherever you go, you know, every room you enter, you're, you know, maybe the most popular or well-known person, and everybody's garnering for your attention, to you're just a regular person. That's a hard place to go. Or like, well, I didn't really have a lot of other interests. I didn't have time to do other things. And that's part of why I enjoy doing this with y'all, because it's something that gives me another outlet, and it's something I'm, you know, I've had interest in, and okay, maybe I want to do this in the future. So let me, as an athlete currently, just work on honing other skills and talents and thinking about other things I want to do. But it's hard to do, you know, a lot of athletes don't take that time. So I can understand how you sort of reach this like halt in your life, and it's a crisis.
I've long thought about even before that shift, just the constant shift within a life of when you are someone who performs for like hundreds of people at a time or more, whether that's athletically, comedically, theater, whatever, being used to that amount of feedback and that amount of praise. And then trying to go and have a personal life and calibrate and care about the feedback and praise from maybe one person or a small group of people, those are such different gears to shift. And I think that becomes difficult for people too, where how could this one person give me the amount of love that 500 people could in a stadium?
I liked his idea of I guess it was all born out of necessity. I went to a place where no one knew who I was. And when I was in New York, if an Austrian tourist spotted me, I just spoke with an English accent and told them, no, it couldn't possibly be. Who were you even looking at? Who are you looking for?
We've revealed a big mystery for a lot of Austrians listening. Yes, that was.
It was him in 2008 or whenever it was.
Yeah, Marcus Rogan was lying to you. He was there in New York.
And I don't know if this is quite the way to phrase it, but to be really world-class at his sport and then, I guess, fortunately and unfortunately, really world-class at being destructive as well. Crashing cars, the people he was dating. And right before we spoke to him, I'd been reading something where he said, I lived my whole life just looking for the camera. Where was the camera? Where are the paparazzi? Why isn't anyone looking at me right now? But to then get really, really good at understanding all the reasons why that happens and then start helping other people with reasons why things aren't as they would like them to be. Yeah, just swimming up and down in the pool is in the grand scheme of this, a very, very small but very essential part of who this guy is, isn't it?
I definitely under one of the questions you actually asked that was really great, Eliza, was the loneliness aspect. I can say I felt this many times in my life. I remember Rio being one of the loneliest chapters of my life because you reach this dream and yet when you're at the games, leading up to it afterwards, if you think about it, so few people in your life and in your world can relate.
When he was talking about those different types of loneliness, I remembered going to when I went to the Just for Laughs Festival, which is a very big comedy festival. It's a big international comedy festival. And it's sort of like if you make it to New Faces, that's the new class of comedians that year. If you do New Faces at Just for Laughs, you've made it to a level of comedy that gives you a little stability. Like you're like, okay, I'm someplace. I'm here. I am recognized. It can lead to gigs. It used to be it immediately led to sitcoms. And I remember being there. We did our big show again in front of hundreds and hundreds of people. I did really well. And then there was this after party with all this industry. And one second, someone would be treating you like you were the biggest deal in the world. And the next second, they would be treating you like you were invisible. And a number of times in this party, I had to go to the bathroom and just sort of like sit down on the floor and be like, I'm a human being, but I am a whole person. Okay, I can go back out there. Because it's so weird, the like, too much, not enough, too much, not enough. But that's also a weird job.
But Ed, I thought you asked one of the really good questions because, well, what was the trauma essentially that led you, drove you, pushed you? And I wasn't surprised by his response because I felt like that was kind of the precipice of why he's part of what he does, you know, why he's doing what he does. But is it not ironic that so many of the athletes that we have interviewed, so many of them have been so successful, and yet I don't think it's coincidence that, you know, he alluded to the study, but in their childhood or growing up in their past, there's been a lot of trauma, of pain, of loss. But I really like that he touched that actually, you don't want to heal the whole thing. You don't want to be completely whole because otherwise, you know, a lot of times once that is completely healed or it's not the motivator anymore, they lose their edge. And that was really fascinating.
That did worry me a little bit because, again, I know so many comedians who are like, oh, I don't want to go to therapy. I don't want to take my meds I was prescribed because what if I'm not funny then? And it's like, oh, boy, come on. There's got to be a middle ground where you're like, oh, I've got these tools and this is how I know where I'm getting into a dark area. But
yeah,
I have to imagine there are athletes with that same attitude of like, this, I need to keep it. I need the pain instead of like, I need to modify how I deal with the pain to a degree.
Yeah, it's a different kind of battle cry.
Yeah. Or like you meet athletes that are always have a little anger, right? They're always because it's like, that's what motivates them, right? And when they don't have something to be pissed off about, they're not as good. And it's like, I have a couple of teammates, not that in my old training group, that they always needed something, someone to be mad about. And when they didn't have that, they were not as good. And it's just, it's an interesting thing to be motivated by, but.
I remember last season when we talked to, after meeting you, and then we talked to Oksana.
Masters, yep.
And just noticing the similarities between her story and your story. Yeah. And I'm like, this probably is not a coincidence, right?
Yeah.
That these people have dealt with such similar trauma and found their way to such similar success.
He's done it, hasn't he? He's got us all looking inside ourselves.
I know, right? You guys have to therapy me. Listen to me and therapy me.
We talked to this guy for the best part of an hour, but it's working.
And that's a wrap. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this series of On the Podium. Don't forget, you can listen back to any episodes from this or the first series on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your podcasts from. But in the meantime, from Scout Bassett, Ed Harry, and me, Eliza Skinner, bye for now.